Welcome back to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. Today's show, we have Neil Peterson. Neil has over a decade of lighting experience, spanning lighting and pole product strategy, layout designs, controls, and a wide range of product applications. As CEO of LED Lighting Supply, Neil leads a team supporting the commercial, industrial, and sports markets with a focus on solutions for industrial, sports, and harsh environments, including oil refineries, factories, and power plants. In his role, Neil has a particular interest in product planning, supply chain strategy, and sales management, providing a bird's eye view into the ebbs and flows of the lighting industry. Before we get to Neil, though, folks, we got to keep it easy. We got to go with the big easy. That's right, KeystoneTech.com, Greg Garrick. That's KeystoneTech.com.
I think we're going to talk about a wide range of topics today, but I know one thing we might get into is sports lighting. And guess what? Keystone is in it. They've got their X-Fit sports lighter. The nice thing about this, one, it's a powerful fixture up to 100,000 lumens. It can be mounted 164 feet high with the ability to mount the driver remotely at the base of the pole. If you're ever doing a sport light project, you know that how getting to the access to the height is very difficult. If you can replace the driver right at the base without getting a lift, that's a win, buddy. Keystone.
Keep it easy, buddy. Light made easy with the big easy. KeystoneTech.com. That's right. KeystoneTech.com. Of course, they're members of the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. If you have a warehouse and it has lights in it, what are you waiting for? This is where all the cool kids hang, buddy. And we're all getting together in September in Dallas, Texas, for our annual convention where we decide the future of the lighting industry. That's right. So if you want to be a player in this game, sucka, you got to go to NAILD.org. That's right, nail.org. What's up, Neil Peterson?
Hey, thank you, Greg and Mike. Appreciate you having me today.
No problem.
Yeah,
and,
thanks. Yeah, so I was reading a little bit on your website that you guys are in 2020 called LED Lighting Supply. That makes sense to me. Before that, started in 2008, you guys were My LED Lighting Guide. Give us the background on where that came from and why you are and what you are today.
Yeah, so My LED Lighting Guide started in 2009, as you're aware, early on in LEDs. LEDs were... Remember that everyone complained of the blue light and that. And so we grew. And in 2020, we felt it, our name really wasn't appropriate for what we were doing. It connotated more of a consumer focus where at that point we switched to LED Lighting Supply. And, you know, so for over the last 10 years, our main focus has been on industrial lighting requirements, sports lighting. And in the last 2 years, we've added poles to that in addition to our standard commercial offerings. But our main focus, we excel in those complex, multiple requirement, harsh environment applications where you may have explosive requirements, you may have high mass requirements, they may have high temperature requirements, such as, you know, in steel plants, paper mills, where they require over up to 200 degree Fahrenheit. So we really focus on those. But in addition, you'll find warehouses, factories, where there are also requirements in those environments. So we appeal to those customers that have broad lighting requirements. Additionally, as you mentioned, sports lighting, we've been just had many successful years in sports lightings and have just been very successful with that as your company has been.
When you started, or were you there when you guys started My LED Lighting Guide?
No, in 2009, I was actually a partner company with them. I was in controls. I was with a company called Simcon Lighting. That was one of the first people really in the control space. And after a period of time, I did join My LED Lighting Guide in around 2014 timeframe. And I've been here ever since.
And the interesting thing when I read that is, you know, I've got a company and a website and all that too, is you know, people do kind of need to still be guided in the LED lighting industry. And were you guys seeing more as an, and were you guys seeing more as educating people and then not selling to people? Is that why you had to change the name? Is it because they're looking at you as a resource and not necessarily a seller?
Well, Google definitely thought that. The guide, yeah. Google. But yeah, no, I mean, in the early days, people really didn't know what they needed. They doubted LED. They had heard of the blue light and it wasn't reliable. So yes, there was a lot of education, you know, up until around 2019, 2020, when we work with a lot of vendors that kind of know what they want, but still, you still get that person coming and say, "Hey, I need a 1,000-watt LED to replace my 1,000-watt metal halide," and you know, and we do educate those people. We do a lot of lighting plans, both full blown lighting plans and what we call quick and easy lighting plans. And so, you know, in the last 12 months, we've done over 2,000 lighting plans for our customers. What a lighting plan does for you is it tells you the fixture we're using, the light levels you're going to get, where they're positioned. So when a customer goes and makes the decision, they know the light level they're going to get. So, so we take the mystery out of, am I picking the right wattage? Am I, you know, are the fixtures where I need them to be? So, but yes, to answer your question, there still is education, but, you know, moving to the LED lighting supply really more represented who we are and our customer, and we've grown significantly since we did that.
Are you guys offering those lighting plans for free?
Yeah, for the customers, once we qualify, yes, we do. That's just part of our sales process. We do a very consultative sale. Customer says they need something. We just don't usually quote that. We ask the questions. We try to understand what their true requirements are. If we feel a lighting plan is required or they've requested one, in most cases we will do one because that just assures the customer that they're getting what they need. And that's the most important thing for us. And I don't know if you were on our website, you saw our reviews, just a lot of satisfied customers. And
you guys have your own software, or are you using just basic lighting photometric software?
Yeah, no. So we actually have a team of people that do it. We use, it's not AutoCAD. It's one of the applications that we use. So our people are well trained on it. Our salespeople aren't doing those lighting plans. We have a group of lighting engineers that do those. They're submitted into the system. They're prioritized. You know, on average, we probably do, we do a lot of them, and they're very informative and they really help the customer. And it also then extends our brand to the customer too, because sometimes some of the lighting plans we do go out to bid, and when the lighting plan comes out in the bid, our product is specified there with the lighting plan.
Yeah, that's something that I wonder about at times, Mike too. I don't know on your end, but doing lighting plans, when it makes sense. I know exterior, it seems like, is when I do it the most, but should we be doing more? Do you do it? How often are you doing it? Like, what percentage of the projects?
Yeah, I find when you're doing lighting plans, like for, he's asking me, I think, right, Greg?
Both of you guys. Mike can have an opinion, on his show.
You know, I'm not. It is our show. I find lighting plans. So I probably target a different market than you slightly. There's probably a lot of crossover, but I find lighting plans are either for very large properties that have specific needs, tough requirements, tough environments, stuff like that. You want to get into that a little bit more. But generally, I find when you're into lighting plans, you're dealing with an employee. And I usually have very good success dealing with the owner or the CFO talking about financial matters and leaving the lighting problem to me. And, as opposed to laying the whole thing out and going over drawings, I find that's more for the, people that aren't decision makers. I kind of stick to most of the time. There are times, like you said, there are environments where you need to really set it out. So my sales process would be the opposite of Neil's. That doesn't mean I'm right and he's wrong. It's just a different way of going about business. We're operating in a context where, people are trying to show their value. And for Neil, I think it's more about this planning phase, and it gives his salespeople confidence. And that for me, my employees do more of that than I do. I swing through the trees with a knife in my teeth, Neil.
Well, I might do that too, but You know, I find they're really, you know, where someone has a 400 watt metal halide high bay in a shop and they have 20 of them, you know, yeah, you don't need to do a lighting plan. Sometimes they like it just for reassurance because they sometimes think, oh, I need a 400 watt LED. But you can, depending on the height, you can do that with anything from a 100 to a 200 watt LED.
It's really hard to screw that up.
Save anywhere. Yeah, you can't screw that up. Well, the only problem I see is they come and say it's too bright.
Sure, that happens.
You know, there's too much light. And, you know, and in those spaces, we're now using the wattage changeable fixtures in many cases. Sure. So the customer can dial it down. So, but I think where the lighting plans really come into play is when you really have high mounting height, you know, where it's potentially a new design or they're reconfiguring their shop or going to a different fixture, or they tell you they weren't happy with their light. You know, on the indoor, on the outdoor parking, you know, again, if you're doing a one for one and the fixtures are pointed straight down, you pretty much know the light you're going to get. But the fields is where we really find it comes into play. And we've probably only in one instance really had a, you know, we do hundreds of these a year as far as from an installation. And we're mainly up to that, you know, that high school level. We do some smaller colleges, but the little league, the high school level. And you really want to do a lighting plan for those because they have expectations on what they think they need. When we provide a lighting plan, we'll show pictures of an equivalent light level.
Especially when you're dealing with a board of directors for a community. Yeah, they're really going to want to look to that for sure. I agree with you on that. It depends on the customer
and you,
in that regard.
But you also run into many towns when you're doing a lighting plan, and we'll a lot of times use Google Maps and zoom in if there are houses around it. You then got to take and play what's the light pollution that's happening. How far out is the light going? Do you need shields? You need to use tighter optics to keep the light more on the ground. So there's a lot of things that come into play when you're dealing with fields.
So in my research, and you're going to correct me if I'm wrong here, Neil, but it looks like you guys have your own fixture brand, meaning you're probably importing them direct. And to me, that makes sense why you'd be more concerned about lighting plans, because you want your fixture locked in. For guys like Mike and I, we're working with manufacturers, and we'll pick and choose whatever is best. Is that correct? Is that what you guys do?
Yeah, that's correct. So we're very involved in the product design or planning and design. We work with about two or three lead factories, and yes, we bring the products in, and they are branded under us. And the thing we do a little differently, and we've found our optics for many of our, we'll call field lighting and even parking light, we've really done some special things with the optics. So for example, in a parking lot, our tight, and because we take other people's IES files, we do comparisons. Our type 3, type 4 optic is just incredible what it does with a fixture that we have that comes with a 10-year warranty. It just, the throw is just so much superior in a dark sky requirement space. And then from the field standpoint, we, in many cases, will use very tight optics or in cases where it's funny, you get a field, you know, the poles are 60 feet, you know, 40 to 60 feet. And then they tell you it's dark sky. So the fixture's got to be pointing down. And a lot of the fixtures out there do not have the right optics to be able to do that. That really requires a very forward throw in a stadium type light, which is not always part of a design. Usually a stadium light, it's intended, you're directional. So, you know, we've gone down that path. We've also recently, as I heard, you know, I heard you, which is a great feature, is the remote driver. We're moving to the remote drivers now. We weren't doing that early on. Not that there's a lot of support, but it just gives the customers that extra confidence that if there is a problem, and we both know if there's a problem, it's going to be a driver, why not have the drivers at the ground level? And it really adds really little cost to the product. So it is we've really moved in that direction or are moving in that direction also.
I would like to advise the industry, this is an industry advisement, that there's no such thing as dark sky friendly stadium lighting. That's not, those two things do not go together. Okay,
true.
An advisement to everybody that the what you need to do is get some good controls on that system to make sure that it's off when there's nobody playing a sport. And that's what we're trying to, we're not trying to stop people from playing sports at night, but we want to make sure those lights get turned off very easily and quickly at the end of the sports game. The idea that something is a stadium lighting can be dark sky friendly, that's a contradiction in terms. By definition, I mean, the whole idea is to create a massive amount of light in a space. And yes, we can do better. Agreed. We can shield things. We can stop light trespass, is what you're talking about before with the shielding onto the neighbors' houses. Right. But we can't stop the creation of sky glow and light pollution from fields. But we can mitigate it by using controls. And that's where I think there's an awesome opportunity for lighting control systems. And they don't have to be super complicated. You know, I don't think it needs to be overly complicated. You know, there's lots of programmable things out there that do a great job. You know, whether the coaches need an app on the phone, or there's a whole bunch of different ways to accomplish that. But the key is to get those lights off when they're not being used as soon as possible. So just a public service announcement for the lighting industry right there. But yes, not that I'm against having sports at night, Neil. You know, let me ask you, so the model's a different model. Okay. So there's something called the distribution channel. I'm sure you've heard of that term before, where, and so the distribution channel basically fell apart somewhere around 2017, Greg, I would say. You know, you saw lots of companies like LED Lighting Supply. And, you know, in Toronto here, we have many Chinese immigrants that are very good businessmen. And they have an inside edge in China because they're from China and they speak Chinese. And so there's a lot of importing, direct importing. I think that model is waning. I think that you know, there seems to be a return to the distribution channel. Why do you think LED Supply is going to continue to succeed with this direct to market import model? What is it about it that you guys do differently that's going to make the difference?
Well, I think we do a lot of surveys. I mean, we're very much a marketing company, and what our surveys have told us is that our customers are looking for a knowledgeable sales staff. That's number one. Number two, cost-effective solutions. Number three, quality. And number four, product in stock. And, you know, their biggest pain points in these surveys is, again, product availability by far. You know, when a customer gets a project, they want to move fast. You know, in many cases, they can wait 4 to 6 weeks, but, you know, they're not going to wait for a ship to come in. The other is, lastly, confidence in the salespeople that they're dealing with, that they know what they're talking about. That's where we focus. Our biggest value add is the knowledgeable staff. And from training, from coaching, and that's the so when you, if you were to talk to one of our customers, they'd say, hey, the guy knew what he wanted. We got the lights when he said he would. The pricing was fair, and boy, we love the light. So you know, we are seeing now a number of the breed like us that you talk about, the non-distribution, and we've seen them, but we've seen some of them go out of business recently. But when you really look at their product offerings, they were in the A19s, they had the can lights, you know, they really were in a mode where those are distribution products. You know, when what we hear from our customers when they're dealing with distribution, they're dealing with a rep or they're dealing with a distributor. The product knowledge is not as high. And so it's where when we compete in that, we're winning because our salespeople know what they're talking about and are really advising the customer based on their requirements, not based on the product we have. So
if somebody were to ask you what you guys consider yourself, what do you tell them?
It's a good question. I mean, I guess we're truly a lighting consultant that sells products. We're almost a distributor 2.0, where we're selling the products. Okay. Yeah. We've taken to that next step. We don't have those channels, or, you know, and that also means we're able to be potentially more cost competitive too, for the same or better quality product. Again, we all use the same drivers. We all use the same LED chips. I mean, all the components come from Asia in most cases, you know, and that's just the reality.
That's an old argument though. That's an old argument.
Yeah.
You know, that's all comes from the same factory in China. Then what's different about you then? You know, I mean, like, well, you know, that's a rhetorical question, actually. But the you know, so the idea that, and, you know, I mean, I'm not here to say what you're doing is wrong. You're obviously being successful in that. But what I am calling to is that I found the biggest problem with the import-export distribution model is that distributors can distance themselves from products that are defective or bad or what have you. We can send them back. In your case, you know, I would say my biggest, if I was up against you, I would play the warranty card on you hard. I would say, of course, these guys, how could they have no warranty, man. They're talking about their own warranty. And if they brought in a bunch of defective products that aren't that good, what are they going to do with them? They're going to sell them to you. That would be my argument against you if I was in the field, if I came across you. I would say you can't trust that company. They bring in their own products. Of course, their products are the best because that's all they have access to. They have no choice. They can't go to various manufacturers and find the best product for them. And I think that's the one flaw in the model that a lot of people struggle with. Now, obviously, your business is succeeding and you're doing well, and that's great. But you know, that's where I think a lot of the people that have fallen out of this position. It's hard in a situation where you have X amount of fixtures in stock to say, yeah, shred those. They're not that good. We didn't get a good batch from Asia. Not everything is the same. You know what I mean? And I don't buy that argument that all the stuff that comes out of China is the same. I don't think it is.
And fair enough. I think what we've done is we've really restricted ourselves. We're over in China at least once or twice a year inspecting our factories. We're part of the design. But products do fail. We recently had a big utility that we sold product to almost 5 years ago, almost out of warranty. 180 units, they were retrofit screw-in, high-end product. Meanwhile, drivers separated from it, but they all started dying. Mm. Guess what we did? We replaced the units with new high bays because those kids...
But that's limited. You can only take so many blows like that.
Our vendors are... Because we use limited... We don't buy from everyone. We're very restrictive, long-term relationships. And, you know, so our warranties are automated. We're very responsive to our customers. And I'm not saying all people like us are, but in the case of, we back up our warranties to the end. And no matter what
until bankruptcy. Until bankruptcy, right? Like this is, I mean, I'm not like, again, I'm, you have a great business, but we're having a high level discussion about the industry.
I think that's
the advantage of the distributor without, that's not tied to the import export. And I think we actually, you know, Greg and I had a lot of conversations about this and with other members of Nailed about what the right move was from say 2014 to about 17. And then I think most of us doubled down on the channel. When you say, Greg, we said, you know what? I think it's better to be on the same side of the table as my customer in that warranty discussion, looking at the manufacturer on the other side of the table and then saying to them, hey, you know what? How are you guys going to support my client today? And if you don't, you're losing all of my volume in the future. There's like a lot of carrots and sticks there in that arrangement that I think are, you know, again, if I was competing against you in the field, I would be very quick to point that out to the customer, right?
Yeah.
And not that, you know, I wouldn't say, obviously, I wouldn't disparage my competitor. I don't do that. But I would say, you know, that this is probably something that, you know, might be thought through a little bit better. And then, you know, at the end of the day, there's only so many of those blows you can take. Any company. I don't care if it's Leadvance or Signify. Or, you know, down to the smallest Chinese import exporter here in Toronto, they can only take so many of those warranty blows before they show up at Atlas counter saying, we're bankrupt. Do you want to buy the rest of my stock for pennies on the dollar?
Sure.
Because I'm out.
That
you know, I mean, that's
to some of the people.
Happens all the time here.
Fair enough. But I think we would both agree, or all three of us, that LEDs are so much more reliable than the old metal, the old HID technology.
I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I think that's wrong.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I'll give you an example. Just the other day, I think we talked about it on the last show, but we're just finalizing this one project. A dealership upgraded their dealership in 2014 to LED, and they had a bunch of burnouts recently, and they couldn't figure out what to do. And in the past, you know, through distribution, so you don't have a history in lighting distribution back into the legacy technology. But in the past, that customer would have ordered two cases of 250-watt metal halide. And they would have screwed in the new bulb and Bob's your uncle and you're done. And maybe one ballast would have been out, but in 8 years, I don't know if one ballast probably would have lasted a lot longer than that, those old core and coil ballasts. And this time, you guess what? The guy was into, you know, $200, $300 boxes of bulbs. He was into $2,000 to $3,000 worth of service work and drivers and everything else to fix the problem because the fixture was 10 years old. The driver was discontinued. The manufacturer was bankrupt. So I would say that it's the opposite. The lighting industry is much less sustainable than it's less sustainable now than it's ever been. from a customer's perspective, from a person who has recently upgraded their fixtures to LED. And, you know, now 10 years later, I love Keystone. I think they're doing a great job. And I think you guys are doing a great job with the remote drivers. But we're just rolling into that in year 10. I mean, you know why? Because in the past, everybody thought they were going to last forever. They're never going to burn out. And so, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of these innovations that we're coming across now were things that were already innovated in the previous generation that of product that we abandoned, and we under the premise that the light fixture is never going to burn out. And suffice to say, guess what? They do. And we got lots of problems. And so I would disagree with that. I think the older technology, you know, energy efficiency aside, yes, there are societal benefits to energy efficiency. But in terms of life cycle, the LED fixtures do not have come close to the life cycle performance of a fluorescent trough or T12 fluorescent troffer, which was in the ceiling for 40 years and upgraded four times from T12 to T8 to T5 to LED. That's some serious sustainability right there. That does not exist in LED fixtures today. So I disagree with you on that. But it depends on what you mean by sustainability or what you mean by performance. If you mean that the new fixtures last 2 to 3 fluorescent tube lives in terms of their life, great. What happens after that, right? And so I think that's where the rubber meets the road, and we're hitting that right now in the market, and where we have, you know, the entire townships changing out all of their streetlights again after 7 years, and they didn't do it for 65 years or 50 years or right. 40 years, right? So I think I don't agree with you holistically on that point. So no, I think you're wrong about that, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
So regarding the import side of it, again, I know I have interest in that because, you know, we've always had discussions on it. And, you know, how we've chosen is to partner with manufacturers, multiple manufacturers that can buy it. Are you guys getting every product out there imported, or are you working with manufacturers at all?
Are we working with...
If somebody says, hey, I need a PAR 38, I need a PAR 30, I need a high bay, I need a canopy fixture, I need a, you know, area light. Do you guys have all of that covered, or do you have to say?
We don't do PAR 38s or any of those type things. I mean, we're more, you know, wall packs. We do source where we aren't bringing them in ourselves, some of our wall packs, some of our canopies to just fill the void, and then we cover them, if there are issues. But again, very restrictive number of vendors. We see a good product, we add another vendor. See another product, we add another vendor. Because again, from a logistics standpoint, you can only work with so many people and get the support you need to support your customers. So,
what is a lead time now on getting a container?
Container, usually a build is 40 days. On the water is probably 40 days, 35 to 40 days. The ports seem a little quiet now. Things are coming into port, and we're seeing the truck within 3 or 4 days. It used to be 10 to 20 days. So containers are coming much quicker.
Is it quicker than when, like within the last two years?
Over time. I mean, I think logistics has gotten better, but around COVID and after, things really slowed down. The lead times really got long and really caused us to plan very far out. And so a lot of cases we were guessing. Fortunately, we guessed right in most of the cases, but
thank God for that.
Well, it was crazy. I mean, you remember that the Suez Canal thing where the container ship got stuck? I mean, that just bogged everything down. Everything took about an extra month or two at that point. So
if you looked at things, 2018 importing a container of T8 LEDs to now, is it quicker now or is it slower than 2018?
It's a little quicker now, probably a couple weeks. Quicker.
Okay.
So, Greg, I'm interested in the bird's eye view. I think you kind of started down this path because in your bio it says that, and I think you do have an interesting view that the average listener to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast wouldn't have. Is there consolidation in China? Have we seen, like when we went over there, Greg, you couldn't, you know, turn a corner without finding an LED factory in Shenzhen, just walking around, and they're everywhere. Like, they're literally everywhere. And when I say that, you're talking about a city of, what, I don't know, 12 million people, and you're walking through the areas, and every single store was making LED tubes and LED fixtures. It was wild. Have you seen consolidation in that market? Are they reducing down? Is there consolidation on the Asian side?
We've definitely seen it. I mean, we... You know, the what we call the little, those vendors that provided every product from a tube to an A19 bulb to whatever, we've definitely seen a consolidation go on. You know, we saw in China probably just prior to COVID, all of a sudden everyone was doing stadium lights. They were moving their whole operation to focus on stadium lights. And then COVID hit. So we did see during COVID, none of the vendors we deal with, but some of the vendors that normally communicate to us did disappear. You know, they disappeared through COVID. They weren't able to survive. And, but we do see some consolidation, just as we do in the U.S. There's definitely going on.
You see growth down the road here? I mean, you know, or is it, are people fighting it out for on the back end of this LED upgrade thing for harder applications, trying to sneak into hazardous? You know, I mean, sure. In my end, like in my market, Ontario, it's saturated with LED now. I mean, the biggest play for me is servicing LEDs that are burning out.
Sure.
I mean, that's what I see as our largest opportunity for, you know, nice orders in the that are in the, you know, under 10,000, but very profitable. That's where I see the future for us in the markets you're in. Do you see it? Are we on the back slope in your mind, or is there still growth?
By no means. There's still huge growth. Still lots of places that are upgrading. We're running into, you know, not where the LEDs are failing, but, you know, where back 10 years ago where you went with a 200-watt LED to replace a 400-watt, you can now do that in some cases go down to 100-watt. So they're able to get another full 50% energy savings on what they're currently paying. So there are definitely an energy spin that we've found customers wanting to go and do those upgrades because, you know, your 100-watt LED can put out 15, 16,000 lumens in many cases in a high bay as an example.
So you've done LED so to LED, a lot of LED to LED upgrades.
We've done it. We've done LED to LED. I haven't seen as many of the where they had to replace the LEDs. I mean, I've seen it, but I don't regularly see where they're all failing and they have to replace them. But I don't question that they're out there. But we see the market still booming. I mean, we're, you know, we're very marketing focused. We've got so many inquiries every day. And we don't see it going down. We're growing year over year. And so I think we're still early on in what I call the retrofit, which is where, you know, they're replacing HID fluorescent, you know, old, you know, fixtures. So
I haven't seen an HID. I saw metal halide the other day and I was like, whoa, there is a 400 watt metal halide. I can't believe it. I saw one the other day. I was like, whoa, this guy, I got to go talk to this guy right now. You still got halides, buddy. What are you thinking? You know, but
it's funny. You go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes visit places too, and it's funny. The utilities I find in their power plants, they still have a lot of HID.
Oh, sure, yeah, sure.
They're the worst.
You know, they are the worst because they're not paying for the electricity. But you know, we deal a lot with a lot of those, and
I couldn't agree more. The nuclear power plants—they're not allowed to change anything here.
No, they're not. They truly need to retrofit because of the engineering effort to change a fixture. And so
the ones in Ontario, they still have 4 foot metric T12s, 1 meter long T12s, buddy. Oh, man, I get a kick out of it. I ran out. I don't have any left. I sold them all to them. I can't get them anymore. But I mean, these are the people paying the rebates. they're not, you know, with the power plants, like there's all these companies around them, the nuclear power plants, where there's all this compliance to change anything. Like, it's very difficult to change anything in a nuclear power plant. Like, I'm turning screw number 36. He's turning through screw number 36. He just turned screw number 36. Like, three people involved in the chain to turn, you know, turn gauge 36. That's how the nuclear power plants run. It's worse than flying planes. I don't know if you know anything about airline, but in the airline, all they're checklist bandits, right? The plane needs to land on a river. Pull out the river landing procedures. And they go through it. My brother's a pilot. He told me, like, there's like the guy that landed that plane on the river, he wasn't cowboying it in. He pulled out the water landing procedures and followed the procedures of landing on the water exactly to a T. You know, he wasn't bringing the plane onto the Hudson River, you know. The nuclear power plants are the same way. They have everything is 100%. He's changing the 40-watt metric T12 tube. He changed the 40-watt, and they check off all these lists to make sure everything stays exactly the way it was built. Otherwise, they end up with, you know, nuclear meltdowns, which would be a disaster for everybody. Right. But anyway, I'm off topic. Greg.
But to get back to your question.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, you go ahead, Neil.
To get back to your question, we see the LED still going high. We're nowhere near any penetration. We see another, you know, 4 or 5 years of the current pace, and what it's going to be beyond that, I don't have a crystal ball to tell you. But the amount of inquiries, the amount of projects we're in, it's nonstop. So,
are you doing any residential? Do you got like multi-residential high rise or anything like that?
Not very little. We really stay away from that. We're not. That's not our. Sorry. That's not our space. That is, they're more looking for the bathroom lights. They're looking for the ceiling can, you know, the can lights.
Corridor.
That's not our space. Yeah, we are truly industrial, commercial, and we really don't stray into that space, and we avoid that. We do get the inquiries, and we, you know, if they need outside parking, we definitely do it. But for the indoor, we really stay away from that. I mean, we do panels, but mainly for our customers that are buying other things and they need some panels too. That's really not our focus.
What made you guys get into poles? I saw you have utility poles, wood and steel. Yeah. You're selling wood poles?
Wood poles, baby.
We are selling wood poles. It is, and no one really knows how to buy wood poles. And it has been a gangbuster for us. And we did it because our customers kept asking for it.
And, well, you know, wood poles are actually, there's an argument that, you know, it goes both ways. Which one has less carbon dioxide emissions, right? I mean, there's actually a legitimate case for the wood pole, which deteriorates and, you know, whatever. It stores carbon and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, and actually wood poles are they have like a decent life. They have the same life as a metal pole if installed properly or plant, you know, whatever they call that, inserted into the ground properly. And it's sure as heck easy to maintain them. And you just screw stuff into them. Is where steels, if you have power lines and stuff like that and lighting in remote areas, I'll tell you, the power guys love wood poles. The power workers, I know a guy, he's like, wood's way better than metal. Because when they have to do something or fix something, they can adjust something up an inch and put in a leg screw there or whatever. Yeah, wood poles make a lot of sense in for a ton of reasons. So I commend you for taking that market opportunity. I might copy you now, though.
We mainly focus on the fields with them. And we've actually got into sirens, you know, around nuclear power plants where if there's a leak, the sirens go off, you know. And we've done some other specialty, but the wood poles have taken off. And for parking, you know, the metal poles under 30 feet, again, our customers had the requirement when we felt it was something that made sense for us to add.
So you talked about education of your employees earlier and how, you know, and how important that is. And I couldn't agree with you more that I think the number one advantage today is not the product, it's the people. And I think, you know, even though whether you bring in your own product or you use the distribution channel, whatever it is, our number one asset is smart people that know about lighting. But you know, we were just having a conversation out here with our crew and they're like, everything's a project now. And when anytime somebody has a lighting problem, whether it's, taking an existing building and changing the lights to LED, or whether it's some problems with their existing LED things, it's a complicated problem that a knowledge worker has to solve. It's not, there is supply on Amazon and stuff like that. And, you know, Smarty Pants goes out there and buys his own thing. We've talked about Smarty Pants, Greg, you know, Mr. Smarty Pants that knows everything and about. Yeah. Neil's laughing for those listening. He's laughing at what I'm saying because we've all encountered Mr. Smarty Pants, who knows more than you know, the lighting professionals about lighting. But, you know, at the end of the day, everything seems to be a project and, you know, where that a knowledge worker has to solve. And I think we need to continue to educate our people into this from this one-for-one mindset that has dominated the industry so long, into the control space, into the darkness restoration and night preservation space, into the repairing the existing LED fixture space without having to rip everything out all the time. And I think that it's not a product issue, Neil. I think it's truly an education, training, and certification issue. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with you. I think when you look at where LEDs are going, it's really how do you continue to sustain them? And so we would agree with that. And we to date have all our products are controls ready, but we have not moved into controls. My background is in that, and we have been in our product planning looking at, as I heard you mentioned, just simple controls, on off, baseball field, the lights can easily be shut off at night, or motion sensors, which we do, to dim down to 10% at night unless there's motion. So we've definitely moved into that space. So I'm in full agreement with you that sustainability is critical to the long-term success of our environment.
Well, lighting plays such a big role, Greg Eric, in energy use mitigation. It's really the only technology that has delivered. Not to beat up the HVAC guys, but we've all seen their proposals, 10-year payback, 5-year payback, 10% reduction of natural gas or electricity on the AC side is monster. Whereas we've been delivering, significance going back to T12 to T8 to T5 to LED. And we've been removing energy from lighting and giving people better lighting systems for years. And yeah, we've made some mistakes, but we got work to do. Neil Peterson, do you have any final thoughts for the Get a Grip on Lighting listeners before we shut this show down?
Well, I truly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And we definitely think that LED is the way of the future, and addressing more of the sustainability and reliability aspects is definitely where the market will be going. I'm in full agreement with you, and we appreciate the time.
Thank you, Neil Peterson. And if you've made it to the end of the show today, you got to quickly go to KeystoneTech.com. If you want to complete with LED lighting supply, bring Keystone in and you'll get them. KeystoneTech.com. That's light made easy, Greg, the big easy.
That's right there, X-Fit Sports Lighter. We talked about, the one thing Keystone does almost better than any manufacturers, listen to the marketplace and adapt based on that. You want a remote monitor? Okay, remote mounted driver, we'll do that. 164 feet down, you can do it that far away and make it easy to replace in the future.
And come check out Keystone at the Nailed Convention in September, Dallas, Texas. Sign up at naild.org. If you got a warehouse with lights in it, you should be a Nailed member. NALD.org. And we thank Neil Peterson of LED Lighting Supply. If you go to the getagriponlighting.com website, you want to check out his LinkedIn, his website, all that will be posted there. You can check him out there. But you guys, all our colleagues out there, we don't have any fans. Somebody said we had fans, Greg, the other day. I said, what are you talking about, fans? We only have colleagues that don't do podcasts. We love you guys. Bye for now.